Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. From the Popcorn Talk Network and producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and Phil Svitek, this is I Talk Movies. Long-form interviews with leading members of the film industry. And now, your host of I Talk Movies.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host for this edition of I Talk Movies, Ms. Keaton Markey here. And today I am lucky enough to be sitting with the writers, the stars. You guys probably did everything on this film that you could possibly do for the movie This Isn't Funny, which premiered last week. Congratulations, first off, to both of you. This is Katie Page and Paul Ashton, everybody.
Thanks,
Katie. Thank you, guys. So it's been a week since the movie has been released. Mm. How are you guys doing?
We're good. We're solid.
Good.
It's like therapy.
It's strange in a way. It feels like all this stuff happened, but then there's also an element of business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, the phones aren't ringing off the hook just yet.
That's not needless to say.
So if you are planning on ringing me, now's a good time.
You want to drop your number right now, yeah?
323. No. Look, there's a huge build-up, and when a lot of planning goes into it with the distributor and with a publicist, and this is just for the release, you know. Mm-hmm. Then there's the 2 years before that. And it was a big celebration. We had a great turnout for the premiere itself. We then went live the next day across a whole bunch of platforms, and we've been doing pretty well on those, and so we hope for that to continue. You can find the movie on iTunes on the US store right now, so if you'd like to watch it, please find it there. We've also played a week at the Los Feliz 3 here in town.
Awesome.
Which was really cool.
Yeah. It's such a great movie. It's so relatable. I like told all my friends to watch it either on Netflix.
It's on Netflix as well, right? Yes.
Yeah. Thought so. I've told all my friends to watch it. I'm in my late 20s, living in Los Angeles. How much of your real life was put into this film?
I think an enormous amount. I mean, mm-hmm. it is semi-autobiographical, but we use the semi pretty strongly because it's not interesting enough.
Did you hit him with your car? Or did he hit your car?
I have several times since we filmed the movie, but beforehand, that's not how we met, in fact. We met on a blind date. Aww. But
that might have been more interesting.
Jury's out.
Time has spoken.
Everything that we wrote comes from, obviously, our point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But we did steal a lot from our friends' lives and from people we know, and we filled out these characters. The parents are nothing like our parents, the parents in the film. We had to kind of fill out their worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, what sort of gave them their worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that's, like, sort of an amalgamation of all the people around us.
But I think
the characters, but the characters themselves, Jamie and Elliot, mm-hmm. are very similar in a lot of ways to the two of us.
And the thematics, I think, we wanted to explore, compare prescription medication with self-medicating
mm-hmm.
Devices or habits. And,
we're less self-involved, but maybe not.
So it did start with us, and then it extrapolates out from there.
So this was, I know you guys said this was kind of a two-year process as a whole. How did this movie start?
It started from a producer that worked with Kevin and Maria and, mm-hmm. and Phil and myself on Serial Buddies mm-hmm. many years ago, about 5 years ago now, Ian Kaiser. He was a producer on that. And he was doing a slate of micro-budget features. He's based out of Chicago. He just called up to see if I had any scripts because
mm-hmm.
he knew that I was making stuff. And Katie and I had been writing together at that point on our web series called Don't Try This at Home, which is on YouTube,
Ooh.
About 7 episodes on YouTube, which is kind of where, our voice, our sort of style of writing came from. And he just asked if I had a completed script. He didn't want to commission anything. He just wanted something finished. And mm-hmm. I said I did have something. I just needed 6 weeks to polish it. And then went home and told Katie we had 6 weeks to write a movie. True story.
What was your reaction to when he said that?
Oh, we broke up for two of the weeks.
Oh my gosh! No, and you still finished it? Huh?
No. Not really.
It was like being broken up with. It was the hostility.
I punished him.
For a while.
But we did write. We got ourselves a little cabin in Big Bear, and we went up there with our dog, and wrote furiously to break the story and sort of outline and kind of figure out who was going to write what and how best to work together in this. Because our web series stuff was really different. It was like one of us would write an episode and the other person would go through and kind of edit and make it sort of a more unified voice. Mm-hmm. And this was going to be such a larger project. Mm-hmm. So we really had to figure out how to write this and what our sort of method of attack was going to be. And we did that all in Big Bear. And then we broke up. And then we went home and we worked on it separately and together for a little bit. And then at the very end of that 6 weeks, just to finish it up, we went to Palm Springs.
Yeah,
we just had to get out of town. It was really hard to concentrate here.
Yeah.
And to finish it. I mean, we got through that first weekend in Big Bear, we broke story. We had 4 days. We broke story. Came up with a kind of a plan and then got out the first 15 pages, like, together.
Okay.
Like really working through it together, which is a slow way of working. Mm-hmm. It's an effective way.
It is also, like, that stuff is in the film largely as we wrote it.
Yeah. And then from there, we split stuff up and had to go back to the world and to life and bills and stuff like that. And so time is... your greatest enemy at that point, and also our different schedules and our different ways of writing.
You know,
not everyone writes the same way, and we certainly don't. And that was, you know, but that was something we hadn't had to deal with as much in the web series because, like Katie said, it was sort of split. And then, I mean,
it was like 3 pages.
Yeah,
plus
her episodes would come finished, perfect. Yeah. Mine would just be a mess, and she'd edit them. That's basically
It'd be like a 5-minute web series episode, and he had like 26 pages, and we're like, I'm going to take it down a little. We're going to edit this whole section about like Nietzsche out of here.
But then we split it up and got through to about the 70th or 80th page, I suppose. And then it was really hard to work out how to finish it at that point, to find time. So we just like cancelled another weekend of work and got out of town and finished it in a hotel in Palm Springs. And then gave that to Ian, and it was sort of missing Act 3. We kind of, you know, there's that time jump between Act 2 and 3. That was kind of, in the original draft, that was just a way of getting to the end of the film. we took it a little bit too far, but it was still kind of finished. It was a finished draft.
And he
said yes. And so then we had the first sort of 20K to get started. And, but we hadn't written a film of that size. You need just a couple of actors in a room about this big to shoot a film for that much money. And these cameras. These beautiful little cameras. I'm looking at you, Phil Spitek.
They're HD.
Yeah, yeah.
They are actually, did we shoot in HD?
I don't know.
We shot
on a red camera, so it's in 4K. So, and that was fortunate because, well, there are technical reasons why that's fortunate. We can go into that maybe.
Reds are amazing.
Yes.
Oh, please, yes. Can we please go into that?
Yeah,
just later, though, if you don't mind.
Yeah, once she's left and no one else is listening, I'll just talk to myself.
I'm sure there's some, like, technical camera geeks out there that would, like, be super into that.
If they're geeks, they know more than I do.
And there's an entire episode of Paul Talks to Himself that you guys can check into later.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
About
after
it.
This, tune in to Paul Ashton Talks to Himself about red cameras.
Yeah. and then we had to go ahead and, we had a start. You know, we had a start.
Yeah.
But we'd sort of set it all just like a film, wherever we wanted. We chose actively not to be restricted by that.
Yeah.
We're like, let's not try and fit it into the budget. Let's write it and fix the problems. Let's paint ourselves into a corner and work out how to get out of it later. And so then we just had to raise more money. So that was the next phase.
And how did you, I mean, because that seems like such a huge process as independent filmmakers to raise the funds. I mean, that's the hardest thing about
that's
making movies. So how did you guys raise the funds, and kind of what would be your advice to other independent filmmakers
We did get lucky in that we started with some seed money, which you are walking into the world of independent film, what you start to figure out is that people will give you money if you already have money. Nobody wants to be the person who gives you the first 10 grand. Mm-hmm. Somebody will be the person who gives you 10 grand after somebody else has invested 10 grand because it tells them, okay, this guy has 10,000 reasons
it's legitimized
that he thinks this
somehow.
Is a real movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a huge part. That's the most difficult hurdle, mm-hmm. honestly. After that, it becomes, for us at least, we, like I said, we started with our seed money, and then we got a producer on board, Lige Sarkey, who's just outstanding and really helped us figure out what we were going to need to make this movie, like bare bones, how mm-hmm. we can make this movie. And we wanted to make sure our crew was filled out to the point where no one felt like they were doing two jobs at once and mm-hmm. only getting paid for one. Mm-hmm. So that was like a huge.
We failed at
except
that.
Except you guys did every job.
We did do a lot of jobs, but not nearly. We did not nearly do as much as some of our crew members who were just outstanding. But yeah, we both wanted to have as much of a crew as possible, and we still had spots that could have been filled in. But mm-hmm. we wanted to have as much of a crew as possible. So Lige told us where we needed to get to, and we started. The next phase was a Kickstarter, mm-hmm. Which we got about. We set a goal of 25,000, mm-hmm. Which would have brought our grand total to 45, although Kickstarter takes a little bit back from you.
Ooh, crowdfunding.
They do. They take a little bit of that crowd money back.
Yeah.
Which we could have done on Indiegogo. At the time, Kickstarter had a lot more visibility.
Yeah.
So we didn't. But I would recommend an Indiegogo to anybody trying to do that now, yeah. if you felt like you could still make something.
Because you can walk with whatever you
want. Yeah,
like
whatever
you've got to make the goal with Kickstarter.
Yeah. And what was kind of the timeline then? So it's 6 weeks to write the script, give the
right.
script off. You got a kind of a base of money. Now then what kind of was a time frame you gave yourself to raise that money
on the Kickstarter? The Kickstarter was 30 days and it was the month of October, right before we started filming October 31st.
We started in September and went into October.
Right, so it was the end of it ended like 2 days before we started shooting.
Wow.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it did, absolutely.
Really?
It ended on like the 29th of October and we started shooting October 31st.
Well, you see, but there's a lot of stuff that happened before that. Because we wrote it in, started writing it in March, April.
Oh, wow.
And then we got that first draft.
So I was wrong. The Kickstarter was our last push.
Okay.
The Kickstarter was the moment at which, like, we decided, like, once you start that, there's no turning back.
Yeah.
Yeah, we already were going to start shooting the movie with or without the Kickstarter money, and we were just going to have to figure
it out.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I think we had to have the Kickstarter.
No, honey, we had all other stuff. Kickstarter was to push across the line of, like, our main budget, which we had set at about 60 grand.
Yeah, yeah. But we needed it. We couldn't have done it without it.
No, we couldn't have, but the wheels were in motion. We already had everything booked. We already had all the actors booked. I mean, what we were going to have to do was get more investors.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We were going to have to work it out.
I'm sorry, that was so convoluted.
It's
funny that we haven't really addressed those little specifics, so we haven't talked about it together yet. But yeah, so after the first 20, then we went out to investors, and what that entailed was just literally asking every single person we knew, do you know anybody who has money who wants to invest in stuff? Or do you have money and you want to invest mm-hmm. in stuff? And we reached out to friends of friends, and we found some amazing people who wanted to know more and were really interested. And then they sort of all came on, you know, it was contingent on each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing.
And how did you guys, like, you know, because asking people for money can be awkward.
Yeah.
Like, how do you do that? Like, what do you say? Like, how do you kind of get them behind you guys? Especially if they're maybe a friend of a friend and don't really know who you are. I mean, you guys are two awesomely talented, charismatic people, but...
But we're not everyone's kids.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So, I would say a lot of that was just about the script and about just presenting our ideas for the finished mm-hmm. film. Paul did a lot of the legwork there.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, there was like one degree of separation from us. You know, mm-hmm. it was either someone who knew us really well, either like kind of a step away from family.
Yeah.
Or if they weren't someone that we knew or had worked with before, the referral was incredibly strong.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was somebody who went, you know, you should do this. It was also, our referrals had all read the script and knew Paul as a director.
And the other thing is, like, we weren't asking for a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Here's, like, if we had needed $200,000 to do this, and which we arguably did need, but I don't know where it would have come from.
Yeah.
It was because we had that start, and we got then we from just like our own personal networks got some investment to bring us up to about just off from the 25. Well, it's actually what we cleared in genuine donations from Kickstarter was about 18. And then we had another, like, the Kickstarter was 32. We raised 32, but about 10 of it was actually investment. It's just paid to us for that
yeah.
one. So I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on Kickstarter. Sorry, Kickstarter. It doesn't make a difference. It makes
no,
difference.
It doesn't, because it, at least you're making your
unless it does, and we'll find out later that yeah. we
well, the movie's made, money's
that.
Been paid, so all right.
It was a delivery system. Anyway, whatever. Let me say this. $20,000 was, you know, was yeah. was donations. And then we had about another 25 ourselves, I would say, from
we're gonna kill her.
We're
gonna
it's confusing.
Kill her.
The point I was gonna make is that we, after the first draft was done, we then got notes from Jason Fuchs, mm-hmm. Who's an amazing writer, who wrote Pan and is doing Wonder Woman now and stuff like that. And that was a very important moment. He helped us really bump it, just really iron out the kinks, the
yeah,
major kinks
yeah,
that were there.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And from there, that was the draft that started, like, that people read, and then we did a table read later. Then we actually took a break right in the middle of the year, and we wrote, a spec. I think it was that when we wrote the Mindy mm-hmm. spec, and, like, walked away
oh,
from
in
it.
Oh, August.
From, yeah, from, we walked away from it and wrote something mm-hmm. else completely mm-hmm. Whilst we were contemplating the Kickstarter and everything like that.
Yeah.
And then came back and did a table read, and the table read really helped. And then we're at that point where some people were like, you should just keep working on the script for another 6 months and just get it amazing, mm-hmm. you know. And we were like, no, screw that. Why work on it for another 6 months to get it this much better, to get
yeah.
5% better when
yeah.
we've got the momentum now? Some, you know, actors were sort of starting to be interested. We were like, let's strengthen action, strengthen in commitment,
yeah.
and iron out, you know, collaborate and make the script better that way.
Do you think it helped to kind of take that month completely away, or do you wish kind of you would have kept bulldozing through to maybe take that time that you took off to make it that little bit better? Or are you kind of glad that you did that when looking back on it now?
I don't have an opinion.
Don't have an opinion on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I
just
think
was
everyone
was.
Always says, oh, it's great to walk away and come back, and that's just sort of how it happened. And I don't think it hurt.
Mm-hmm. No, there was an opportunity, right? We felt like there was an opportunity that we
yeah.
had to punch out this spec for something else, you know. And we were like, we got to take that. Someone wanted to read something, so you just do it.
Yeah.
I think it probably did help walking away for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then
it's easier to kill your darlings a little bit once you've done that.
Yeah.
Because you're not, like, so obsessed with this thing you wrote 2 weeks ago. It's
yeah.
like, oh, a month ago I thought this was great. Now I think it's crap, which is going to happen every 4 weeks in a writer's life. So we had that time to be able to go, okay, this is not necessary. Cut so much fat.
And you guys shot it November, what, 2013, 2014?
The second through to the 15th.
No, but from 2013.
Oh, 2013.
2013.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, in it, 14 days. That's what, like, blows my mind.
Yeah.
That you guys shot that in 14 days. I mean, talk about saving money that way, but
yeah.
how did you do that?
Oh, it was a lot.
I blacked out.
I remember.
I mean, we did 20 pages in the first 2 days in Big Bear. That
mm-hmm.
was, you know, we got a cabin in Big Bear on Airbnb, and we all slept in it. And that was the opening sort of 2 days of the shoot. So everyone was like baptism by fire. I'm actually glad we got everyone early before they knew what had hit them.
Well,
they
yeah,
were
we
exhausted.
Took them up to Big Bear so they were like, couldn't get away.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm going to drive home.
It was like a horror film.
To Los Angeles.
And
we have you now.
And they had that energy of like, this is a new thing. And then like, we just killed them for 2 days.
Well, you know, we were lucky. Like Katie said, we had Lige, who brought together a great team of people. I brought a director of photography who I'd worked with before, Peter Borish, who's Australian and therefore awesome. Who's just an absolute workhorse,
mm-hmm.
very, very talented. And he only had one camera assistant.
It's literally crimp. I mean, it's amazing
just,
that we,
you know.
Were you guys shooting just 24, like 48 hours straight?
No.
No.
I mean, it was a 16 and a,
yeah,
a 12 hour day.
Yeah, we did go overtime in Big Bear, but that was really
the only time we did that. Overtime.
Yeah.
There were 2 days. It was the first, one of the days in Big Bear, and there was one day in the second week that was a tough one.
Oh, at the warehouse.
But everyone kind of was down for it there because we were there. You're away for the weekend,
yeah, yeah.
And you know, we just made sure people were fed well. I gave them lots of pep talks, and you know, and but also people had sort of read the script, and I think they thought it was kind of funny, and we just tried to create a sense of a team and creating something. If people get behind it and in a creative sense
yeah.
and feel like they're contributing, and like everyone there is there because they love movies,
mm-hmm.
like that's why people decide to work in it. And if you can find a way to work together and inspire everyone and empower everyone to be part of the creative process.
Yeah.
And that was something we really wanted to do, and everyone had to be by necessity. I think it changes the stakes for everyone. It changes their investment in the hours. It becomes more about telling the story the best way you can with a limited amount of resources that you have.
Yeah.
And everyone feels they're part of it. They've got some skin in the game.
Yeah.
And it means that getting stuff done, like, under mental conditions has more of a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at this level, no one is getting paid well enough to be doing it because of that. You know? I mean, I'm sure you could be on any television show in this great nation and be like, yeah, I'm getting 20 grand a week, so that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
But this was like, everyone showed up because of the spirit of, you know.
Yeah, they were taking a pay cut. Every position was. But they were coming for Lige, because Lige had worked with them before, and Lige kept working with them, and he sort of got behind us and brought a great team. And then I think then they responded to us for what we were bringing, and then it sort of everyone felt like they were in it together. So those first 2 days were really brutal. And then from there, there were two sets of 2 days where we were in one place, like Elliot's apartment and what's the other one? Was
there
the
warehouse? Downtown.
No, that was one day. That went over because we did all of that in one day. There might have only been once.
The warehouse, your apartment.
Ryan and Jamie. No, it was one day, I promise you. That was a 14-hour day. That's why. And
I did sleep in the middle of that day. I had a fever. Went into a fever dream and then like came out and was like, is it a new day?
No, it wasn't. No, so we were virtually in a new, apart from one location, we're in a new location every day, and some days had two.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, we just booked it tight and executed fast.
Yeah.
And I think probably because it's there's a lot of just the two-handers, and because we knew how to work together fast, or we had no choice to, but we had done that before.
Mm-hmm.
And some people were questioning, you know, whether we should both be in it early on. I certainly was, whether I should be in it and be directing. That was a big decision to make.
Why? Tell me about that decision, and like, what was your opinion on that decision, and why did you finally go with the decision you made of doing it, of like both of you being so involved in the writing process as much as starring in it, probably producing it a little bit as well for you, and then directing it for you. What was all of that like?
My opinion on whether or not Paul should be in the film was based purely on who I wanted to look at for 2 weeks. and who I wanted to, like, pretend to have sex with and just all
Tom Hardy's agent's got a restraining order out against
him. Yeah, okay, I had a list of all of our friends that I thought would be much better suited for the role. But in the end, it came down to what people were investing in and what people were going to pay for was us, the two of us.
Yeah.
And so we just banked on our...
They weren't offering much.
No. Yeah, they didn't pay a lot for it. I'm just saying, just like...
I mean, Jason, we asked Jason Fuchs this, actually, and he was like, you have to both be in it. I mean, I think it was important for Katie. It was very much, I think it was a very personal story for her. And, you know, we talked about, we said, oh, what if we get names to, you know, friends, famous friends to be in this, just to try and move the needle a little bit. And it's like, well, what's the point? It's kind of our story. And you do it at this level, you do it at this upstart level to give yourself a shot, you know.
Yeah.
And Katie's an amazing actress and hadn't had this kind of opportunity before, so why the fuck wouldn't you do it?
Yeah.
And for me, it wasn't as important to me to be in it.
Mm-hmm.
Then Jason said, why would you not be in it either? Like, when would you get to do it like this? For me, it was practical, mainly. It's like...
Save money,
but also time. People... The concern is, right, like, being in front and behind the camera is going to cost time.
Yeah.
I've made a few short films, and I've always done both, just because no one ever wanted to work with me, so I had to do both. And so that's just a skill I developed, just getting in
and
front.
And the rest of us have developed the skill of not working with you again.
it's a ghost town. And so I felt pretty comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
I also trusted my DP because I'd worked with him, Pete, on a short before. And Katie and I had done it together. Like, I directed our web series. So we were good at being in stuff together and just going, did you get that? Did you get that? Yep. Is it in focus? Move on.
We'd already also written everything together.
Yeah, so you knew.
So
we knew where we were going. We knew why that scene existed, why that character was saying and doing those those things, we'd already hashed everything out.
Yeah.
So that shorthand.
The thought of getting someone new in and risking the chemistry being diluted.
Yeah.
We felt like we had the right chemistry and actually that we could actually go faster. Just two takes. Did we get it? Move on. That's it.
Yeah. That's amazing.
But also Paul loves to pretend that he's not an actor. Like, you're being so ridiculous. He's like, yeah, it was just going to be faster. And also, Paul is amazing, and he's so lovely to watch, and I think the character is so much more likable with Paul in it.
What's happening right now?
I'm not used to this.
No, you both are amazing on screen.
Like, I can't imagine it without him, and he looks really good on camera.
Well,
I don't know about these cameras. You guys might be like, I don't know about that. But check out the film. He looks pretty good on camera.
Yeah. And the chemistry between you two, too, is just, it's natural. It's obviously you guys are a real couple.
Well,
unless there has been another breakup since last week. But
Every 2 weeks. Not really.
Look, that's what we felt. That's what we hoped for.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we did, you know, all the festivals that we have been to through this year and then through the feedback from the release so far, like the vast majority of it, that's the one thing that we feel confident about. So it was the chemistry, you know, and not everyone will agree, but it certainly felt like that worked out. I think it was the right decision.
I think it absolutely was.
I don't think we could have done it as quick. I don't think we quite could have got what we got.
Stop it with that speed shit. We also like each other. Yeah, we work well together. And that seemed like a good thing to run with.
Yeah.
So the other kind of really unique thing about this film is the stand-up comedy in it. And I love what you guys did with it. I've never seen a film that has done that. And if you go out and see the film, you'll see that there's interspersed throughout the story, there's these scenes of stand-up comedy that you put in black and white, which I would like to know why you put that in black and white, first of all. And just kind of where that idea came from. And also, did you just give them a topic to kind of do stand-up about, and then you just found a place to fit it in, or was that kind of somewhat scripted? It's a lot of questions.
When we started going, what are we going to write about? Mm-hmm. Katie has done a lot of stand-up, not as much at the moment or these days, but when I met her, she was doing a lot, and with some of, you know, at a really high level in LA at some really great shows. I got to see, I mean, that, I got a really good, like, glimpse.
His impression of what high level is, though, is
I don't know. Like, there's some really like outstanding comics that she was sharing the stage with, and my thought was that was a great place to a very fertile kind of territory to start to put the story, and then the immediate like lead on from there logically was that, well, we can like get some of your friends who are amazing and like cast them in it and set something inside that world, because it kind of fed into the or balanced out or supported this idea that we wanted to look at the sort of the anxiety disorder stuff. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like just as it's a natural fit.
Anxiety and stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people that I know would agree with that.
Yeah.
And actors and comedians generally, I feel
it,
like,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I can't remember how I think I just thought it would be fun to just rip off some very, very successful people like Seinfeld and Louis C.K. and just try and, you know, and thought, what if we take some people's jokes and intersperse them in a way that, but not just randomly, in a way that, oh, I mean, it's exactly what Seinfeld did. You in a way that just touched on or expanded on or counterpointed exactly what was going on in the narrative. So it was a while to find. It was hard to. Well, we knew who we wanted, and we ended up getting them, which was great. It took a while to get there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to put a show on right in the middle of the shoot, an actual live show, and just shoot it for real, like not scripted, not like a real comedy show.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's like, "You're crazy! just get them to do the jokes you want them to do and shoot it like, you know." And I was like, "No, I'd rather make life more difficult if possible." So we put on a show at Fado Do, that's where we were for 2 days, Fado Do, which is a club down in West LA, and they were amazing. I mean, they gave it to us, just so generous with their time and you
don't,
know,
don't
everything.
Don't tell on them.
Yeah, don't throw them under the bus.
Yeah, don't rat them out.
Well, I think they knew what we were doing and they just supported it.
That's awesome.
You know, and so that's what we did. We shot all day in there,
wow,
and then turned around in an hour and set up to do the show and had about 100 people come in to watch it. We got some great comedians like John Doerr, Hampton Yount, and Nick Rutherford to come in and do sets as well as Ahmed, Will, mm-hmm, Katie, and Beth. And had three cameras going and just ran it. And we just said to them, look, you know what the movie's about. Whatever jokes you've got that are about, like, sex and parents and, I mean, just everything that comics talk about,
yeah,
really. And they just did it. And then Spencer Avrick's the editor, we just looked through everything and went, oh, that could go there, mm-hmm, that could go there. And it's mind-blowing how some of the... I mean, especially a lot of, like, Beth's jokes just fed right into what we were doing. Jokes that she was telling at the time a lot that, you know...
Yeah, we knew what their jokes were. I've seen them perform, you know, dozens of times, and I hoped that's what they would tell. But at the same time, we wanted them to use their own voice and just choose what they wanted to talk about. And then when we were able to use that, you know, and it fit the thematics, it was great. And when it was just a lovely break from whatever was going on, or a lovely way to look at what we were talking about with some kind of seriousness in the film, mm-hmm, and a way to bring humor, then we used that too.
Yeah.
So that worked out really well.
I mean, sometimes it's safe. Sometimes it allows people to laugh at a very uncomfortable moment, you know, mm-hmm, like, so certainly after the sex in the woods kind of stuff, like Ahmed's orgasm joke is just what everyone needs, because
yeah,
it's kind of confronting, you know, mm-hmm, and that's the point. And I mean, for me, it's the element that just gives this film a little bit of an edge. It's a rom-com. It's like got a little bit of an edge to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the element that, I mean, I'm one of the elements I'm most proud of. And so grateful to those guys.
Yeah, we're very proud of our friends' jokes.
Yeah, of our friends being geniuses.
I literally went up to every single one of them and was like, when are you performing next in Los Angeles so I can come and see you?
They all have websites. They all have Twitter. You can see... actually, Ahmed just was on Conan, so that's going to be definitely searchable.
Yeah,
he was on Conan just a couple weeks ago.
And Beth Stelling just did her first comedy special on Comedy Central.
Comedy Central, her first half hour. Amazing.
And Will is extremely active on Twitter, Facebook,
and has Old Man Weldon
has his own podcast as well. Mm-hmm. And
Little Angry Goats, I believe, is
yeah. And they all have just such different styles.
They do, and that's what was so I felt that was so interesting is that they were all very different comedians.
Totally.
And so the fact that you got, I think you used four different ones, right? Four different ones. The fact that all of those just naturally fit into that story, I think it just it's kind of a testimony to the story you guys wrote and how relatable that is and how current it is for kind of our generation.
Well, and the other interesting thing was that, you know, like Ahmed's humor, the quality of Ahmed's humor and the way that he thinks about things and structures his jokes, which is quite brilliant, is nothing really like Russ, his character. And so...
His character is not Russ. Wait, you're talking about Ahmed? Oh, Ahmed,
yeah,
sorry.
Ahmed.
You're right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I see my Will.
And so we... to answer your question about the black and white,
yeah,
you know, the film starts in black and white and fades out.
Yeah.
And it was just about just delineating a little bit between, like, the fiction and the real. I wanted it to be, these are the comics and these are their jokes,
yeah,
in real life.
Yeah,
but
leaving
also,
Ahmed his identity as Ahmed.
Yeah.
But they're also still acting in the movie. And
yeah,
I just loved it being a little bit unclear. And but yet
just breaking
distinct.
That wall a little
yeah
bit.
Just but yet distinct. And it also black and white is makes anything seem like it's like more sophisticated. So I needed that to
very sophisticated.
He's so good at his
job. As a black and white
as
film.
You like cut this to black and white, and
yeah,
then like all of us are all of a sudden
cut
like
it to black and white.
Phil, black and white. Go.
Make this look really, really.
Then all of a sudden we're just
cool,
like
Casablanca, or
yeah, sipping coffee in a newsroom. Like, what do you got on the news there?
so then if this was shot in 2013, then so the kind of post production process was the biggest. Oh no,
that was the longest. No, but here's the thing: they're actually. I mean, post production was very long, but it's also a timing thing. I mean, even if it hadn't taken that long, we still would have used that whole time because we had the releases planned.
Yeah, it's actually
it, so you had the timeline in place.
We screened the point, yeah. We did the first screening like in like small industry screening in New York in July 2014.
Oh wow!
So yes, we had a cut that people were looking at that wasn't that different from the one.
No,
that,
it's about a minute longer. But it was like we'd done a full. We had to wait 2 months to get Spencer Averick to do the edit after November because he was on another. A job, and then I lost him early. Like I lost him on May the 1st because he had to go and start working on Selma because he's Ava DuVernay's editor.
Yeah.
And so that that then like month or two where I had to kind of still cut out, find a way to lose another 2 minutes, and with just on a technical level because we were cutting in FCP7. It was the last thing Spencer ever did on Final Cut Pro 7, and I think any editor ever did on Final Cut Pro 7.
I don't know about that. I feel like I have an uncle who's editing family videos right
Final
now.
Cut yeah, it's FCP.
And I mean, Phil, I was just running around town trying to get help fixing stuff, and then getting the sound. We did the sound, the post sound in Baltimore. Out of Baltimore, so I've never actually met in person the guys that did the amazing surround sound design on this film. It's some guys called it's called Studio Unknown, and Lige works with them a lot, and Ian and myself now, and they just do incredible work, and just at a price that is just it's crazy how much they charge in LA for post production sound.
Well, sound
like
can make or
double
break film,
the cost.
Oh my, really?
It's nuts. And these guys gave us a very competitive quote, and so you just ship everything out, and then you get it back, and it works great. And they were incredible. And but still, for me to manage that on my own, as someone who knows a little bit about editing, but nowhere near the in terms of deliverables, the technical files and OMFs and this stuff, it was tough. So that was a very challenging couple of months because then we're also trying to get a cut together for Toronto because then we're like starting to think about festivals. And it wasn't a finished cut, but it was a rough cut, which they do take. So that was really, really, really tough. But then once that was out of the way, we got the sound design back from them and got a color grade done. And yeah, we showed it in July. So really, that's pretty quick.
I was going to ask you if you remembered the question she asked.
Yeah, I know. I go on long
No, but this
tangents.
Is, I
do you
think
remember
this is so...
where we started?
Yeah.
There. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
He got back there.
The time.
Yeah,
he did.
He did. He got back at the end.
Yeah.
So it's like it's like long form improv right now.
Right. that's how people would.
Has about the success rate of long form improv.
Yeah. Yes. People are as interested in that as they are talking to me. Thank you, darling.
And there's an entire episode of Paul Talks to Himself about FCP7. If you guys are interested, just you can tune into that.
Downloadable
right
on iTunes
this.
For free. Yeah.
Yeah. It's right after this.
Free downloads, guys.
It's actually not even just free. Like you make money. Paul will pay you.
You've given me an idea, and I don't think you're going to like it. anyway, so then there was obviously we did that screening and we thought it was over, but it was not over because I wanted. Well, here's why: because in that screening, that version, we had a track by Robin, "Dancing on My Own" by Robin, was in the drug taking dancing scene, and at that point we were still negotiating the license, and we expected to get an offer. And the executive producers felt like the song worked so great and people loved it so much in there that we should just find a way to find the money. And they weren't even interested in a quote, which is very unusual. Mm-hmm. I mean, usually everything has a price, but not apparently they just weren't even interested in finding out. So we had to change the song out. So that gets complicated in terms of the sound because it's...
Do they have to do to ship it out again, redo it?
There's all sorts of stuff. But then,
and
of course,
yada, yada, yada.
I also wanted to shorten it again. And
yes.
Then we put in an Aussie track called Lights and Music by Cut Copy, which
yeah,
the
one
the
you
beginning.
Heard, yeah.
And we kind of had that in there till the end. And then we got, like, then, I mean, to basically we ended up having to get rid of that again earlier this year. So... It's back and forth, and then when you start doing that, that's when the money starts costing you a little bit more.
Yeah, music is like the worst. It is so expensive.
Yeah, and we found we knew enough people outside of those bigger tracks we were trying to use. We found that we were able to use a lot of friends and sort of friends of friends who are amazing and talented and don't have the platforms to show off their music, and
Yeah, I mean, Matt Morse that? Butler gave us three songs, just gave them. He's a mate of mine. There are three of his tracks in there. We had a band called Wishful from Australia, who are the daughters of Paul Kelly, who is kind of like the Johnny Cash of Australia.
Wow.
And they just started their band, and they weren't signed yet, and so they were prepared to give us three songs from their EP for Bargain Basement, and amazingly generous. So, you know, we saved a lot of money on music. That was really, this one song was the one that we, I mean, if we had our time again, we would have, you know, just gone for smaller,
mm-hmm.
and we would have used a music supervisor, get a music supervisor to do these negotiations for you. It makes such a difference. I just tried to do it myself, and you're just probably paying a little bit of money. If you can get a referral to an up and coming supervisor, they will provide you with options mm-hmm. of what songs to choose from and then negotiate the licensing for you. And it's just, compared to what the big songs cost,
mm-hmm.
it's really worth it.
Well, with everything else you guys are worried about with, you know, getting it to festivals, what was the first festival? In Toronto, was that the first one that it screened at? Or?
No, submitted to.
Submitted to,
that was the
okay.
beginning of the submission.
Okay.
So that's then, like, so we're ready by then. That's like well over a year ago. But then the whole journey through festivals and distribution is what adds the extra year.
Yeah.
I mean, really, we were in and out, like, written, shot, and kind of like cut within mm-hmm. within under 18 months.
Wow.
I mean, written and shot in 9, and then from November through to July. So
our first festival that we screened at was in Cleveland.
In Cleveland?
Yeah.
And what was it like kind of sitting? Did you guys screen it with the film?
Yeah, it was outrageous. They first of all have one of the most supportive, lovely communities there. They have an actual tax that everyone agreed to in their county that goes towards arts education.
And they get 100,000 people through the doors
days.
In 10 days. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
I didn't know Cleveland was that much of a kind of...
It's crazy.
It's 40
hub.
Years old, their festival.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a cultural institution in the city, and the support is enormous. And they said to us in advance, don't worry about anything. Like, you know, just turn up. They don't do red carpets and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there are people everywhere.
Yeah.
We actually ended up selling out one of our screenings. They had to open another theater.
And it sold out as well.
Yeah.
Like,
that's
just
so amazing.
So as far as first time out, it was wild.
It was really good.
Oh, my God. No wonder you guys are kind of like, now, because it premiered last week. But to go through something like that.
No, everything is exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about it is exciting. But I think we also got used to, in the very beginning, people telling us, oh, once this happens, then you're... That's it.
You've made it. Yeah.
And people told us enough times where then something happened and you're just like, okay, we've got to just be happy with how the film turned out, how we feel about it,
mm-hmm.
the response from our family and friends who are really important to us. And beyond that, everything is just a bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mark Duplass said it in his speech at South By this year that the cavalry isn't coming. That was the first thing he said. And it's true. I mean, even on Monday night, which was an amazing high, people were like, oh, you've got this amazing review. This is like, the phone's going to start ringing, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's all going to change. And that's one of the hardest things to kind of work out, because you every time you set yourself a goal, whether you're a writer or an actor or a director or a musician
mm-hmm.
or almost anything in life, you know, you hope to, but especially in the arts where there's not a structure like there is in a more regular career, you're looking for feedback or kind of a result
mm-hmm.
from effort, you know, and you set these goals and you hopefully achieve them, and people often say, well, things are going to change, and then sometimes they don't, and you just realize you've got to know what it is next. You've got to reset the sights. And so on Monday I was just on cloud 9,
mm-hmm.
but you know, the days later you're just like, well, it's back to square. It's not back to square one.
No, it's just back
like,
to work.
It's back to work.
Yeah.
Let's just get back to what we were working on. There's no time,
mm-hmm.
to not, you know, so, you know, that's that tone that you're probably picking up on. It's not a lack of gratitude. It's not a lack of excitement. It's just a bit of a reality check.
Yeah.
And I have to give them to myself, because I'll still get too excited or too depressed. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah,
it's
no,
both.
It's like,
there's no point.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
no, you've got to try and measure your responses to things, because it's inevitable. It's a life lesson. It's a lesson in arts or career or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to try and take the highs and the lows with the same response. You've got to treat good and bad reviews with the same amount of disregard.
Mm-hmm.
They're all just opinions.
So
know?
What do you guys hope this film allows you to do next? because this was 2 years of your life. You guys put a ton of effort, a ton of energy, a ton of just your talent into it. And I think it turned out phenomenally. And for, I mean, because this isn't your first feature film that you've
directed. It was your first feature
that you directed. And for, is it your first feature that you wrote as well? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's so incredible to me about this film is how the level and how good it is. And like that this is like kind of you guys' first like shot at it. And you guys kind of knocked it out of the park to say well, the least. What do you hope it does next?
Well, look, the goal going in, the goals were simple. Try and make everyone's money back and move every key creative up the ladder one rung.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give everyone the chance to just go one rung higher, whatever the fuck that means for them. Pardon my French. You know, and so that hasn't changed. I mean, I really want to make it, you've got to put, I certainly had to put blinkers on a little bit for a while, when you're asking people for money, especially people that might be close to you or, you know, when they've invested and you think that they think you're not going to ask them again and you have to and stuff like that. You've got to kind of just eyes on the prize.
Yeah.
And then now it's over. My eyes are on like, I really, really want to make their money back.
Yeah.
So, and we don't have a lot to make back. You know, like we've done really well. We've kept it. We just passed six figures. You know what I mean? Like,
wow.
I mean, after post, we were at 90, which is kind of crazy. And just a testament to the kind of people we were working with, really.
Aside from getting the money back, though, creatively.
Yes. No, sorry, I was getting there. Just long,
but
money, long tangents.
I mean, but that's a huge thing because when you're putting so much of your time and effort into this, you want to be able to reward the people that have helped
faith,
you,
yeah.
that
Absolutely.
Had felt faith in you.
But then it's like, yeah, to make the next one. We want to. I want to go on and make
next.
An. I mean, make another one.
Sequel.
But well, no.
I
don't know. I mean, perhaps a logical progression, or just another thing altogether that's in the wings that but you know need $1 million for. So
yeah. Anybody out there with $1 million, you can trust
just hit me
it
on
in
Twitter,
the hands of these
at
guys.
Captain Pash.
Yes, people with $1 million who are also using Twitter.
I don't know.
To
what
give money
what do you
away.
Think?
Taylor Swift uses Twitter. She has lots of millions.
No,
of dollars.
To give money
oh,
away. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What do you think, Katie?
Creatively, the goal for this is I want to work more. I want to work more in the industry. I want to write. I want to perform. I want to act.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that this. You know, people talk about it as our calling card, and it's not, it's hard because you do so many things and you feel like it should be, your calling card should be like your body of work or your amount, you know, all the things you've sort of created along the way. But I'm really proud of this and I hope it helps me, I hope it helps open doors so I can go in and, you know, use to get other jobs.
Yeah.
And to keep... Gives people like confidence in you if they're like, I need something written and I'm not sure who I want to write it. And you can say, look, I wrote this thing. Just sit down with me. We'll talk about it.
Yeah. What has been your favorite hat to wear throughout this entire process for each of you?
I don't know. My favorite hat. Probably, I don't know. I guess I would instinctively say the acting hat. But at the same time... writing this was so fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And writing something that people really connected to. I mean, the performance, is a whole other thing, and I know people have connected to that too, but it's the words and it's the story that I'm really proud of. So I think probably the writer's hat. And that sort of is kind of a producing hat.
Yeah.
Once you got to set.
Yeah.
The directing, that's what I want to, you know. I love it all. I mean, just love being on set and like anyone really who does it, and had a great time with every element. But you know, that was the thing I really wanted. I was focused on most, you know. And for me, looking forward, like I'm ambitious to do better. It's really a confronting and exhilarating thing to have it out there now. Like, cause once it's out there, it's out there. You know what I mean? Like you have no control over it anymore. And there's a, no one gives a crap about the fact that, like, how little we made it for, mm-hmm. or how fast we made it, or there's no disclaimers, there's no, like, context. It's just a movie.
Yeah.
You know, and so then, yeah, it's an amazing achievement. Everyone who knows, like, it's an amazing achievement. People say that because of getting something made is so hard these days, and we did it cheap, with some great people, and that's all good and well. But then when people just see it as a film, like, I know that I can do better. Yeah. I know that I want to do better. I know that I want more. Like, and I don't think, like, under the circumstances, it's like, yeah, we made it work. But you can't, under the circumstances, is like, not a thing on the other side. So my goal next is to, like, on the other side, do better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
craft
no,
it better.
Yeah,
have a little more time. Have a little more, just more experience, artistry, maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it exists. You know, that's the terrifying thing about keeping going, because it's like, what if this was it?
I don't think this is it for you guys. This is not Michael Jackson's. This is it. So what is next?
It's a darker end than I think I imagined.
Yeah. What is next for you guys? Anything kind of like, that you guys can talk about, throw out, anytime we can see you guys, any of your writing besides on your YouTube show, or?
Well, there are things in the works, but mostly we're going to get married next.
Do you have a date?
Yeah, we're getting married in September of next year.
Oh, my goodness. So going from, like, and planning a wedding, though, I work in the wedding industry, it's very similar to producing a movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think I do understand that it's, like, so many moving parts and so many plans and so much money, all for sort of one event or one series of days, you know, as mm-hmm. your event. And then I think there is probably that same feeling when it's done. Of, like, everyone talks about, what is it they say afterwards, how brides, like, go into, like, the post-wedding.
Yeah, it's like postpartum depression.
Yeah.
Yeah, postpartum, but.
I think, you know, that feeling is probably really similar on the other side of it. But I think it's not going to bother me one bit when this is over. Once I am done planning this wedding, it is going to be the best. The day after I'm done planning this wedding, which is the day after the wedding, it's going to be the best feeling ever.
Awesome.
Yeah, you do get it. You do get it. It's tough coming off something, for sure. You know, definitely.
But it is kind of nice. It's sort of like producing.
Yeah, you're producing your
I'm
day.
I'm producing
it's
our wedding.
Your, yeah.
My day,
I
yes.
I feel a little bit like that.
It's not really my day, though. Like, it's more, I'm producing my mom's day. Like, I'm putting my own touch on it, but it's my mom's day.
This is Katie Talks Weddings, guys.
Yeah, I also have a Katie Talks Weddings, and it starts and ends with, I don't care.
Yeah, it's going to be great. That's a whole other production that we got to work out, but that's going to be fun.
Awesome.
Lots of people coming out. I'm thinking, I have a script I'm hoping to direct that some other folks wrote that we're trying to raise money for.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have $1 million and you're on Twitter, you can find
support that
Captain
script.
Pash on Twitter.
Right now, it's not for me to throw out there. We're trying to like go to some sort of big production companies, basically.
Awesome.
Because of the money that we need for it to pull it off, because it's sort of a period piece and it's got kids in it. So
cool,
it changes
yeah.
the amount of time that you need to shoot.
You only get
by the time
eight
we make it, it'll be
yeah.
like.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, there's no more Kickstarters happening in my life ever. Kickstarters are
that is a bold statement, sir.
Yeah. Well, I don't think so. I think you can only do it once. I can't ask my friends and family for money ever again. I cannot. I have burnt that bridge. And they were amazing. But I couldn't. No, it's people have got to invest. Like, professional investors have to invest from now.
I can't. I mean, your parents are going to write that down. That you said, like, you're never asking them for money.
She's
again.
Like, what about for the wedding?
Yeah, I mean,
don't say that.
Really shitty timing to say that, pal.
I know. So there's that. That's kind of going on in the background. And then sort of Ian and Kevin Undergaro and I have been mm-hmm. talking about just maybe something similar to This Isn't Funny. Just like for the next, like maybe in early 30s
yeah.
kind of thing. I've got a little.
The next progression of people who have no idea what
right. they're doing with their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like
me. Good genre of movie to
my
make.
Friends, my friend, like all my friends have kids now. And I don't. And so I think there's something in that. And
oh, absolutely.
So that might be something to like churn out fast and try and do again for cheap. Maybe not as cheap, Kevin, if you're watching.
Kevin would watch us talk for this long.
I know, that's right. That's just a running joke.
Like, Kevin might.
Cannot get involved again.
But yeah, so I'd like to do that. But like you said, it's 2.5 years. It's a long time. I've been thinking about that this week. I've been going, oh, okay, that's 2.5 years to do this.
Yeah.
That seems pretty normal. And it's a lot, and it's amazing, but it's like, okay, where do I want to go next? I got to make my decisions really.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's taking it too seriously.
Am I?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the thing. They say, like, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And I think it sounds like a lot, like 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And certainly this was the biggest basket that we had. or this was the most eggs. I don't know what the expression would be.
Yeah, I don't either.
But the point is that I think you have to have other outlets. You have to be doing things simultaneously. You'll manage your time better, and you will be more creatively available.
Mm-hmm. That's
if you
true.
Do it that way.
That's true.
So I think it's silly to say, oh, the next two, what am I going to do, 2.5 years on another one movie? It's like, no, you're gonna put your time towards this movie in addition to whatever else it is that makes you happy, fulfills your financial need, whatever it is you have to do. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, hopefully you're going to have a product that you can look back and say, I did all these things the last two years.
My gosh.
Because I wouldn't say, looking back the last 2.5 years of our lives, that this is all we did.
No, and it's not.
We did a lot.
It's not. No, I was being reductive.
We
absolutely.
Broke up and
just got engaged.
And we got
or
engaged.
Have you been engaged for 2 years?
No, we've been engaged since April.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've done a lot.
Yawn. Jesus.
Yeah, wow.
No, sorry. They were unrelated.
Well, then pay attention.
Well, last kind of words of advice, you guys. Like, this has been amazing to kind of sit down and just talk through about the whole process with you guys. And any, I feel like, independent filmmaker could, you know, learn something from this. So any last words of advice? You just had a great monologue. So if you want to, like, just kind of drop the mic there, you can. I'm like,
yeah. Can I throw this one on the ground? Just kidding, Phil. I won't do that.
Don't do it.
It wasn't that good. It was, like, this good.
Yeah, just push like the mic.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it's just what I've been thinking about lately that seems to make sense.
Do you want
to
give
me.
Him a word count, though? give him a
is,
specific
is
word count.
Is the producer as entrepreneur? As an entrepreneur.
Yeah, okay.
I've realized in some stuff I've been reading and listening to lately that there's no difference between an entrepreneur who has a startup and what a producer has to do. And you extrapolate out from there that if you're an actor or a writer or a director or whatever working here, there's an element of the producer in every one of those careers. You have to mm-hmm. understand how to produce your own career and your own work, especially because of the way that it works now. You know, the cavalry is not coming and that you are your own engine, and you've got to work out how to get the balance of like working within the structure mm-hmm. and finding fulfillment mm-hmm. in your own work no matter what. And so start thinking of yourself as an entrepreneur, and that opens out. Stop reading wanky self-help books about being an artist. I mean, do that as well.
Yeah.
Like, give yourself all of that, but also understand that the people who excel as entrepreneurs in the world, there's a series of patterns that exist between amongst those kind of people, and I think have a look at those because mm-hmm. There's a lot to share and steal.
Book,
from them.
Person, or words of advice that helped you most with this past 2 year process.
Oh Jesus, Paul has a huge boner for him.
Well, he's only I've been Tim Ferriss lately, the 4-Hour Workweek, and his podcast is what mm-hmm. I've been where all that what yeah. that diatribe came from. It's not particularly original. It's not mine. But that's only since the film finished. Really, mm-hmm. during it. You go. I've got to take a minute.
The most recent thing I've been really thinking a lot about is Stephen King's memoir on writing. And he talks about how he doesn't sit down and write out a whole backstory for every single character and plot out everything that's going to happen. He gets an idea, just an idea, and he sits down and he just starts writing and sees where the character takes him and what his character does. And I think that's so interesting. And then he goes back through and says, okay, here's some themes I've really hit on and I want to kind
expand.
Of really expand mm-hmm. on those. But awesome. He just goes, okay, here's this woman. She's miserable. She lives by herself. All right, what's she doing today?
I love that.
Yeah.
Stephen King.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of an amazing way to look at it because it also gives you a lot of freedom that you don't have once you've outlined your thing to you know, the high heavens, mm-hmm. which is something you have to do a lot of times because that's what you are getting paid for.
Yeah, and you're kind of like taught, you're taught to give structure to an art form.
Oh, yeah.
And art should not have structure.
Yeah, every single book is about what needs to happen at the beginning of Act 3.
Save the cat.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, maybe there's another way to look at it. I don't know.
No, I like it.
I think, I don't have a book per se, but I think one of the most influential things early on was just other artists, other filmmakers who did stuff that inspired mm-hmm. me to, or us to just keep going when mm-hmm. it felt impossible. You know, and so people like Jon Favreau, and his, what he's done with his career, mm-hmm. and then specifically, Daryl Wine and Zoe Lister-Jones and their film Breaking Upwards, from years ago now, mm-hmm. 2011 probably, which was similar, like a semi-autobiographical film about their relationship and their breakup at the time, and that they made for about $15,000, I think, and it went to South by. It was like, right, yeah, it was really impressive. And it was just that thing of like, just get off your ass and do it, and don't stop till it's done.
Yeah.
Just find a way. Get up. You know, don't read anymore. Don't ask questions. Like, don't look for inspiration anymore. Just like commit to action.
Well, you guys did it. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with the wedding. So where can let everybody know again where they can support this film,
this
film, and support you guys as individual artists.
You can get this film on any of your, wherever your streaming heart desires. You can do it on iTunes, Google Play, Amazon, Netflix.
The U.S. stores only right now. Yeah. Only in the, mm-hmm. like, so for iTunes, it's the U.S. store. So if you're listening to this outside of America, you can find an IP workaround. Mm-hmm. You'll be able to pull it off.
And you can check out our website at thisisn'tfunnymovie.com.
thisisn'tfunnymovie.com. And there's a link to the iTunes there. And awesome. We're on _thisisn'tfunny_ on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I'm at Captain Pash at Twitter. She is at
_KatiePage_.
Right. Yeah. And then we're on This Isn't Funny Movie on Facebook. Like, amazing, Facebook.
Yeah.
So if you want to hit us up, find us there. And awesome. and if you like the film, please rate it. Please give it some like nice stars and ratings on IMDb or Netflix or iTunes, whatever. Those really help us. Please tell all of your friends about it if you think it worthy of that. And thanks very much for listening and supporting, and thanks for having us, Kate.
Thank you guys for talking for so long with me. I really, really appreciate it. And everybody out there, I mean, support This Isn't Funny. It's actually hilarious. And support other independent films out there as well. Support these guys. They're amazing artists. And thank you for supporting AfterBuzz and Popcorn Talk. We really appreciate it here. And we'll catch you next time on iTalk Movies. I'm your host, Keaton Markey. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Keaton Markey. Thanks so much for watching and listening. See you next time.
Bye, guys.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.